Bill Hancock has joined us here on Sports Byline. He's the executive director of the College Football Playoffs. And, of course, the title game will be played on January the 7th, 2019 at Levi's Stadium. That's just outside of San Francisco and Santa Clara. And previously, he served as the first full-time director of the NCAA Final Four and also spent 11 years with the Big Eight Conference, first as a media relations director and then as an assistant commissioner. I've known him for more years than we both probably care to admit to, but I've always had interesting, insightful conversations with him. And Bill, before we talk about the championship game and everything that's going to be here in the Bay Area, let me get your read on the landscape in college sports today.
You know, we're doing great things for young people. Young people are getting started on the path to life because of college sports, many of whom would have been pointed to a different path if it weren't for college sports, so I'm proud of that. There's some issues we need to work through. I don't know an industry that doesn't have issues to work through, and some of ours are being taken care of, and I'm still very bullish on our industry.
There's a dynamic with sports when it comes to money, and I think the whole, when I look at the landscape of sports as long as I've been around it, I just think it's something that is very difficult to get your head and your hands around. Do you see it that way, especially you who have been associated with it longer than I have been?
Well, there's complex issues, and smart people are working through those. I think we need to, my compass is on remaining within higher education. And there are those who would want to push us to be something else, something outside of higher ed. And we just can't do that. We would lose our identity, we'd lose our purpose, and we'd certainly lose our compass. We need to do better for the athletes. We are. I'll give you one little example. When we started the playoff, the NCAA allowed us to pay the travel expenses for the student-athletes' parents to the semifinal games and to the championship game. So we do that. We found the money, we set it aside, and we said, this money is going to let those family members go get to watch their sons play for the national championship. I'm very proud of that, and I think we, all of us in higher ed, college athletics, need to continue to explore ways to do more for the athletes within the context of their being students.
You know, it's hard to admit or at least understand student-athlete. We hear that an awful lot, but we hear about the money that's involved with college athletics. What is it that people don't understand about that?
Well, I think people don't think about the fact that college sports is the front porch of the university, that many people see, a lot of people's connection, only connection with the school is through college sports. And whether they went there or even didn't go there, but that is such an important connection for us. And I don't think people drill down and think about that. They may think about the Texas Longhorns or the Oklahoma Sooners or the Stanford Cardinal, but they don't think about the underlying university that is the reason there is a Stanford Cardinal and Texas Longhorns.
Did you ever think you'd see a football coach make $11 million a year?
You know, I know a little bit about what the old great coaches used to make, Duffy Doherty, Daryl Royal, and on and on and on, and didn't approach what these guys are making. But I would say that Daryl Royal and Bud Wilkinson and company faced a whole different world in terms of pressures and in terms of job responsibilities. Were they undercompensated for their time? I don't really think so. Did they miss the boat in being able to be compensated the way these people are? Of course they did. But we have great leaders in college sports. You know, the 1% or 2% are the ones who make the headlines, but the ones who are doing it right across the board, and I mean every sport, not only football and basketball, but across the board in the sport where my daughter-in-law coaches women's soccer, 99.9% of the people are doing things right.
You've been associated with sports information for a long time. You're in the Big Eight Conference, and I'm just wondering, as you look at the landscape today when it comes to media coverage and how sports is being reported at the college level, you're smiling, so I know what you're thinking.
It's so different. I was just thinking about my first season as a full-time employee in college athletics was 1971, and there was one game on television every week, and it was a remarkable experience when you could get your game on national TV and Chris Schenkel and Bud Wilkinson or Bill Fleming and Frank Broyles would come to your stadium to do the game. And I remember that Supreme Court case, just like you do, from 1983,
yep,
which opened up television, and people were saying, woe is us. The finish of the industry will never be the same. And the fact is, it just the opposite happened. The sport, all sports, particularly football and men's basketball, ballooned after that. We brought in more fans who were able to watch on TV who never would have gone to a game before. And they became fans, and they joined this army of people who have this awesome passion for college sports. So that decision that was decried by many turned out to be a good one.
I remember talking to a couple of friends. We were at dinner. One was a well-known football coach, the other a college basketball coach. And I said, what has changed when it comes to recruiting? What's the question you get asked today, what you didn't get asked before? They both said, how many times are we going to be on TV this season, coach?
Yeah, we have college teams now whose every game is on television.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about the championship game on January the 7th. Here in the Bay Area at Levi Stadium. It's going to be a really interesting time to see that game come to the Bay Area.
One, it will be. And one thing we are intentional about, is that we wanted to take the championship game around to different parts of the country. This was right off the bat when we created the playoff. And that has proven to come true. Of the first 10 years of championship games, each one will be in a different stadium. And I like that. I like the fact that we're bringing top championship football to a place that's never been before, the Bay Area. It had never been to Tampa before we took it there. And I like that. And in a couple of years, we're going to Indianapolis. It's never been there before. That's a way of bringing the game to people who hadn't been connected with it at that level previously. So people in the Bay Area will have a different experience, a great experience. It's not the same as Super Bowl. We're not the Super Bowl. We don't try to be the Super Bowl. The worst thing we could do would be to try to be the Super Bowl. They're on a level above everything else in America. But there's a great niche for our game, and we have tremendous, obviously, viewership on television, and folks who come to the game have had a great time. So this will be a great, great event for the Bay Area.
What is the challenge, the biggest challenge for you as executive director of this?
Maintaining the game and the event as a rather understated, if you will, part of higher education. I do feel a tug to pull more towards Super Bowl, and we hold on to what we have. I'll give you an example. We have marching bands at halftime. We don't have Beyonce, and that's great. Marching bands are such an important part of college football. The whole pageantry is what makes college football, frankly, different than pro football. And so we have marching bands, and that's who we are. We're marching bands. We're college football.
How concerned are you about the legalization of sports betting when it comes to college sports, college football?
I don't have a lot of professional interest in this because our game will be fine no matter what. But I have significant personal interest in it. I have, first of all, I have witnessed the horrible corruption that has happened occasionally in college athletics because of gambling, and I would never want that to be repeated. I have witnessed, in many cases, on a personal level, the social costs of gambling, and I would be horrified if college athletics led people down that path that led toward, in the case of some of my friends, people losing their families and their whole, frankly, their whole existence because of gambling. So that's sort of on the negative side. On the more positive side is I think it will be controlled. I think the colleges will get together and hopefully come up with some kind of federal legislation that will make it where it's the same from state to state. Back to the negative, I'm an old school guy. I thrive on the emotion of college football. I thrive on cheering for State U, where my granddaddy went to school. And I wouldn't thrive on, I got $100 on what play they run on 3rd and 2. So enough said.
Yeah. In about 30 seconds, is there a particular moment in your long career as far as sports that you will never, ever forget?
Oh, my goodness. I will never forget my first Olympic Games, 1984 in Los Angeles. Watching Carl Lewis, I will never forget that as long as I live. I'll never forget seeing Vince Young run around that right side in the end zone when the Longhorns beat USC. I'll never forget Keith Smart's basket at the Final Four. I'll never forget talking to Dean Smith when North Carolina got ready to play Georgetown. So many great memories.
Bill Hancock is with us in the studio. He is the executive director of the college football playoffs. And remember, that title game will be played on January the 7th, 2019 at Levi's Stadium. That's just outside of San Francisco. There's another side to Bill Hancock that we're going to explore in the next segment, because I've known him for a long time, and he had a very, very talented son. And we'll talk about that aspect of his life as well as we continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on Sports Byline. Bill Hancock has joined us here on Sports Byline. He's the executive director of the college football playoffs, and I've known him for a very long time. The first time I met him is when he came out with a book, which I will talk about in just a second. But he had a wonderful son by the name of Will, who is the media relations coordinator at Oklahoma State University, and he died tragically in a plane crash carrying the OSU staff and basketball players. Nine other members of the OSU basketball family died in that crash. And he did something after that besides writing a book. And I hope if you get the chance, you'll check out this book. It's called Writing with the Blue Moth. And I'll tell you more about what he did. But Bill, a tragedy like that, I've always asked athletes when they've had this sort of situation, did the discipline of sports, the focus of sports, help you get through such a difficult time? And I'll put that to you as a starting question.
Everybody's had grief in their life, and if they haven't, they will. And what made ours different was we were in sports. Will was in sports, and I was in sports. And one difference was our tragedy was on the front page. Most people's are not. And the second one was I had all these hundreds and hundreds of friends of mine and Will's who carried us through that time. I would not have gotten through it without people like Barry Switzer and Mike Krzyzewski and Roy Williams, and I can just go on and on and on about the people who got us through that. Our fraternity, a family of sports, is the most remarkable, caring group that I know of. So we were lucky to have been carried through the tragedy by all of our friends.
Was there a particular point from the moment that he passed away to when you finally did cross over to some degree and got able to move on with your life in a sense?
You never leave something like that behind. People talk to me about closure, which is a word I don't like. There's no closure. I wish Will were sitting here in the studio with us today. I wish you could have spent more time with him. There's not closure. What there is the realization that, hey, I can put myself together and live again. And there were days and weeks when I wasn't sure about that. But that light came on for me. I don't recall in the instant, but the light came on and it said, you know what, you can live again. You'll have a hole in your heart, but you can live again. And again, it was the people in sports who got us through that.
There was a very poignant moment, and you talked about it. 10 days before the plane crash, you had a nightmare that he had been killed in an accident, and you even told him about this nightmare. Tell me about that moment.
Yeah, I woke up. I dreamed that he was killed in a crash, and I woke up sweaty and turned sideways in the bed, and it was horrible for about 30 seconds until I realized it had only been a dream. And so that was January 17th of 2001. And I called him as soon as I got to work. He worked at Oklahoma State. I was director of the NCAA tournament. And we talked for, I don't know, half hour, more, just about everything, about their team, about his mom, about his new baby daughter, Andy, who was 2 months old at the time. And it was the best conversation. And I, at the end of the conversation, I said, love you, Will. Talk to you later. And that was the last time we talked. The dream was a part of a remarkable series of things, Ron, that happened to me that I wouldn't have believed if someone else had told me. I would have thought they were making it up. I would have thought someone was making up the dream. I would have thought on a Saturday night, January 27th, 2001, my wife and I were in the grocery store shopping for supplies for our little two-person Super Bowl party. The Super Bowl was the next day. And all of a sudden, Nikki, my wife, said, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I got to go home. I'm terribly sad. And so we put the groceries back on the shelf, and we went home. And 3 hours later, we got the phone call, and it was at the instant when that gloom descended on her that the plane crashed. Now, I wouldn't have believed it if someone had told me, but I have personal evidence that things happen that we'll someday we'll understand. When I get to heaven, I'm going to have my hand up. My first question is going to be, I hope I go there anyway. My first question will be, Lord, why have you been so good to me? And my second question will be, tell me about what provincial karma, whatever it was, that went from Colorado to where we were in our home in Kansas City at the instant the plane crashed.
Tell me about the genesis of the book.
The book goes back to the genesis of my having decided to try to ride my bicycle across the country. And as I think about it, why I did that was having lost Will led me to realize that life is short and we have to grab our dreams when we can. And I had a dream, a goal, a passion for seeing if I could ride my bike across the country. So I thought, hey, I don't have much time. Who knows how much time? I better try to do this. And also it was to return to long-distance endurance events that Will and I had enjoyed together. So I rode my bicycle from Huntington Beach, California, to Tybee Island, Georgia, 36 days on the bike, about 90 miles a day. By the way, I drank 2 gallons of Gatorade mixed with water, so I got 45 miles to the gallon. But every day I wrote an email to our other son, Nate, and his wife, and to Karen, our daughter-in-law, and some friends about where I was, what I'd done that day. And included in the group of friends was a guy named Jim Host, who was a publisher. And Jim read the emails and read them all and followed me across the country. And he called me and said, you need to write a book about this. This is a remarkable experience. And my first thought was, no, I can't do that. I don't want to exploit the situation. And Jim kind of insisted. He said, I'm not the publisher to do it. You have to find a better publisher than me. So that's how the book came about. And I'll never forget the first. I wasn't sure about the book, but within a month after it came out, I got a phone call from a stranger who said, Mr. Hancock, this book has saved my life. I have been in your situation. I am in your situation. I had no hope. And seeing the hope in your book has turned my life around. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, what have I done here? Unintentionally, I didn't do this to turn people's lives around. But that was a remarkable phone call. And they keep coming. The book's, you know, it's still in print. You can get one on Amazon.com for a 99 cents. Put my name in there, but I still hear from strangers who read the book and tell me how much it meant to them.
And I
recommend what happens, Ron, when you write a book. Almost nobody calls you to say this book is terrible.
I want to recommend it to everybody. If you go to Amazon, Writing with the Blue Moth. What did you learn about yourself in light of the tragedy that you went through that maybe you would not have learned if you had not taken that trip?
I thought I was calm. I thought I was understanding of people. I thought I was a pretty good person before. And looking back, I was selfish and just didn't have the heart that I thought I had. I have developed more compassion for people. And every life is valuable. Every person is valuable. Every moment is valuable. I didn't really realize that before.
What did you learn about this country when you traversed it?
Oh my goodness! We went through small towns. We rode on the back. I rode on the back roads. I had 2 segments where I had to ride on the interstate. That was awful, but I had to do it to get from point A to point B. I learned there are remarkable people in small towns across America. I would stop to get water or Gatorade, and every time I stopped or go to the restroom, every time I stopped, I would buy something. Well, the little stores, the heart of small towns has moved from the corner drugstore downtown, which is not there anymore, out to the convenience store on the outside of town. That's where the old boys go to have their coffee. And in one little town in Oklahoma, I went in and I got filled up my water bottles and bought some peanut butter crackers, and I started talking to the guys, and we had a good visit about sports in their town, and it was fun. And I left, and I rode about 5 miles, four maybe, and I realized I left my water bottles in the store. So doggone it, I had to turn around and go back. And I walked in that little store, and the same guys were still sitting in the corner, still drinking their coffee. And one of them said, "What are you doing back here?" And one of the other guys said, "I understand. I've been trying to get out of this town for 30 years, and I can't do it either."
That is so funny.
Remarkable people in small town America.
One of the things I have found with my trips to Iraq and Afghanistan with our servicemen and servicewomen, that sports is such a great bridge to home. It's a binding factor. I let the soldiers co-host each hour, and I'll share a story with you. I'm in Afghanistan, and so I found that the soldiers are knowledgeable enough, I could get up off the set and walk away and let them talk about sports. Well, one of them was a Raider fan. One of them was a Denver Bronco fan. One was a major, and the other was a sergeant. So they're talking back and forth, and I look over on the table, and I see they don't have their ranks. They took them off, and they put them on the table. So I asked somebody, "Why is that?" And the guy said, "When it comes to sports, there is no rank." But what did you find as you traversed the country as far as sports and the love in different parts of the country for sports?
Yeah, I did get people talking about sports, and I only told one person what I did at the time. I only told one person I was director of the Final Four. And he was a guy selling at a little gas station in a corner of small town. And he said, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "Well, I'm director of the NCAA Final Four." And I'm going to have to bleep myself here because he goes, "You got to be bleeping me." But I did get people talking about sports. And I remember a guy in Alabama, an African-American gentleman in a real small town. And he got talking about Alabama-Auburn. And he said, "I don't really care." But he said, "During the week of that game, I get out of town because I can't stand them."
What's your most indelible memory of Will?
My son Will was brilliant. He was happy. He was creative. And he and I used to play. We were bound together by sports, and we were bound together by love of classical music. And when he was about five, he and I would play touch football or tackle football in the yard. And he would be Texas, and I'd be Oklahoma, or I'd be USC, and he'd be Nebraska. And we would play until dark, and his mother would finally have to call us and say, "Boys, come in." And I'll never forget those days of playing two-man football in the yard. He'd win some games, and I'd win some, and a lot of games were decided by a last-second field goal, kicking the ball over the hedge into the neighbor's yard. That's a memory I'm so glad I have, and I'll never lose it.
What do you want people to take away from the book?
Well, take away from the book is that there is hope, and you can do it. If whatever situation you're in life, you can get through it, and just know that you're not alone, and just remember there is always hope.
As you mentioned, you're a changed person. You became more compassionate, more understanding. And it's too bad that it has to be a tragedy like that. But when you talk to people, what do you tell them?
Well, my daughter-in-law says, Karen says, I understand, but we paid too high a price to learn all that. And she's right about it. But that's what I tell people is cherish every moment and treat others the way you want to be treated. Life isn't very hard. If you do those things, you've got it made.
Yeah, we only have about a minute left, minute and a half left. But you think of all the people that you met on this journey, Bill, and you mentioned about one. But is there anybody else? Was there a kid or was there somebody else that jumped out at you?
Yeah, I met an old boy named Steve who was selling peaches by the side of the road in McRae, Georgia. And Steve just gave me some philosophy for life. He said, he weighed 400 pounds probably. He said, "I don't want no money. I don't want no car. I don't want no house." He said, "All I want is what I've got here selling peaches." And boy, there's a lesson for life. Cherish what you have.
And there's also something in a lesson in sports. I think it gives us, I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on it, but you've been around it longer than I have. What is it?
Well, I just think hope. I think, first of all, enjoy who you're competing with, your teammates, but also enjoy who you're competing against. And just know that there is hope. And whatever happens in this game today, you got another chance next week. And so, and that's the greatest metaphor for life is keep fighting through it and go tee it up again next week.
In about 30 seconds, you've been doing this for such a long time, and you have such a positive attitude toward it. How do you maintain that?
Well, I think you have a positive attitude from day one, however you grew up. I was raised to never complain about school teachers. If anything happened at school, it wasn't the teacher's fault. It was my fault. And so that's how I grew up. And just know that life is so short. Why ever waste time being bitter or complaining? It's a total waste of time.
Bill, it's been a long time since we've got to get together face-to-face. Let's not make it so long, and you're always welcome here at Sports Byline. And thank you for sharing the story of Will and about the journey across the country. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Ron. You've got thousands of friends out here, and you deserve every single one of them.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Writing with the Blue Moth. I'm Ron Barr. We continue on Sports Byline.